We don't mind.
Thank you.
We don't mind.
Well, of course, Gosport is my home, and we grew up in Privet Road in Gosport. You remember that? We were right next door to the bus stop by what used to be the school there at the back in the park. And I left Gosport in, I think it must have been about 1976 or something, which gives you an idea how old I am. It was when the Bay House was known as the Grammar School. Did any of you remember it then?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. What school did you go to, Jean?
I went to Bridge Mary.
Oh, you're right. So you're a bit further up the road, weren't you? That's right. Yeah. Well, I remember thinking I'd really like to get into television, which wasn't something that ladies did much in that day and age. And I wrote to all the television companies to say, you know, how do I get in? And they all said, oh, you have to do a degree in English, and then you have to do work on a newspaper, and then you have to become a stringer, and then you have, and it was, the list went on forever. I thought I'd be a white-haired old lady before I ever got there. But in the end, I went to see Thames Television. And they said, do you know what? There are lots of jobs here that both men or women could do. So why don't you just get into the company and see what happens, see what you can find. And I thought that seemed like a good idea. So I went off to Highbury Technical College. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that's right. I did.
A highfalutin shorthand typing qualification. And I have to say, in all the years that I've since been a journalist, there have never been any skills that have been more useful to me than doing shorthand and being able to type like the wind, especially for a book writer, I can tell you that. But actually, that led to me going up to work for Thames Television. And, you know, the very first job I had was as the programme secretary on the live evening news television programme for London. And the presenter, now I wonder if you'll remember him, was Eamon Andrews. Do you remember Eamon Andrews?
Mm.
What a lovely man he was. He was actually very shy. He didn't Eamon talk Andrews to people very comfortably at all. Do you remember him, Mark?
This Is Your Life.
Yeah, among This Is Your things. Life.
Yeah.
In fact,
and Desert Island Discs at one point.
Doing that programme every Wednesday, he had to have off in the week to do This Is Your Life. And even though we were in the office next door to This Is Your Life, we never knew who it was going to be until the day. Did you like it in those days, This Is Your Life?
Yes, and my mother used to listen to it fanatically.
And similar shows. Yeah.
She liked Franklin Engelman and Down Your Way and shows like that. And yeah, and so I listened to it with her quite a lot.
Oh, how lovely. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, aren't there, of those old programmes that I guess we're not far off the same age, but, you know, that were sort of stalwarts of those
I was born
years.
In 1956.
You mentioned Down Your Way. Do you remember Sing Something Simple, Cliff Adams?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
On
That's
Sunday
a bit
afternoons.
Dimmer, that, yeah. I was born in 1956.
Were you? You're a little younger than me then. Well, and what about you, Jean? Are you younger as well? Everybody's younger
than
yes,
me. I'm very young. Yes, yes. I'm 73.
All right, so there we are. We're all around the same age. And what radio programmes or television programmes do you remember most of all?
I remember. Oh, I can't remember off the top of my head. Didn't watch a lot of television, I must admit.
No.
I can remember.
Do you remember Uncle Mac?
No. No.
Uncle Mac on the radio on Saturday mornings, children's favourites? No. On the radio?
No. No.
It's like a nice chat.
Ah, well, anyway, I went to work, first of all, for Eamon Andrews, which was, you know, really interesting. And I became a presenter quite by accident, really, because I'd always learnt dancing at the School of Dancing in the High Street in the High Street in Gosport. I'd learnt it all my life, really.
Still there.
And although I did dance professionally for a little while, it was
pretty hard.
But because I ended up teaching dancing in the East End of London, just as part of a youth club, really, an after school club, the lady in reception at Thames said to me one day, they're looking for a new presenter for Magpie. Do you remember the Magpie children's television programme?
Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah?
Once
well, these
sorrow,
were in the days
joy.
When Sue Stranks was the presenter, along with Tony Bastable. And are you all right, Mark?
Oh, I'm very excited because my beloved and I are into magpies and we always say, good morning, Mr. Magpie, when we see one. And we sing the song, one for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy.
For a boy, yeah. Which ends and that in, song. And it went, magpie at the end. Anyway, I did an audition for that. It was the very first time I was in front of a camera. And the audition was funny. I had a parrot on my hand, and which was gripping quite hard. And they asked me things like, well, would you hold a snake or a spider? Yes, I said. And would you jump out of a plane? Yes, I said, I'd do any of that. Not thinking that it would ever come my way. And it didn't, because they wanted a named actress for Magpie. And Jenny Hanley got it. Do you remember Jenny Hanley, the actress?
We are sorry to hear this. You would have been...
Yeah, she was. But I got stopped in the corridor after that by a schools producer who said, would you like to present a school series called The World Around Us? And the very first week, what did I have to do but jump out of a blooming plane? So I wished I'd kept the big mouth shut and not said. But anyway, yes, parachute jumping and all sorts of things. But that led on to doing other work as well. British Forces Broadcasting Service. Have either of you got any connection with the military at all? Have you? Yeah. No? Neither of you? Well, you'll know that a lot of our troops were out in Germany in the 1970s, and BBC and ITV worked together with British Forces Broadcasting Service to present recorded programmes across all of the British programmes that could be shown to the troops out in Germany. So I sat in London doing links to link all these programmes together that went out to Germany. And in that way, eventually met someone who put me in touch with Anglia Television, and I was presenting the local evening news programme on Anglia for about 7 years before I came into contact with Songs of Praise. And it was interesting because I don't know, what did you work all your life, Jean? Were you a working lady?
Yes, I was.
What did you do?
Well, my husband and I, we had a fish and chip shop in Bridgemary for 26 years.
Oh, have you?
Yes, and then I ended up my last 10 years working for Lloyds Bank.
Right. Yeah. So how did you combine being a mum, being a working mum with children? Did you bring up children through all of that too?
Yes, yes. I used to take them to the shop with me.
Yeah, I bet they loved it.
In the pram, sitting in the back yard.
Yeah. Yeah, and I must admit that sort of tussle of, you know, having children. I had two children, Max and Bethan, and you know, before they came along, making the decision with my husband that we would have children. And I was obviously in a job where I was travelling quite a bit. Mm. And I was very wary because I had a friend who worked in the City of London who was quite highfalutin, and then she married someone that she met there. And they ended up with her having three children under the age of five. So she had her hands full, you know, it was very different from what she'd been used to. And at that point, her husband came home one day and said, you know, there's the whiff of promotion in the air. And I wondered if you would mind if we invited my boss and his wife around for dinner. And she got very excited because she hadn't done anything like that for a long time. So she, you know, she insisted that the dining room was decorated. She organised for the children to be away for the night with her mum. She planned the menu meticulously. She bought a new dress. And there was a point in the evening when everything was going really well and the boss was sitting beside her and they were having an animated conversation. And she thought, I can talk to people who are over the age of five. And then she realised that his expression was changing a little bit. And when she looked down, she was cutting up his meat for him. So any one of us who are mums know that feeling. But I think actually having a television career and being travelling around quite a lot is always quite difficult when you're married and you've got a family as well. I'm married to Richard. And he's a roofer. He's a roofing contractor, so a fairly down-to-earth sort of fella. But have you? But you've obviously got a wife because you mentioned it, Mark. Have you got your husband still with you?
No.
You're my wife, apparently.
No. Well, anyway, Richard is still with me. But I do sometimes wonder whether he misses the point of being married, and you know that the romance in our marriage has gone out because. Well, you tell me what you think about this. He never comes shopping with me. He hates shopping. I mean, he told me he liked shopping before we got married. But anyway, I always just insist that before Christmas, we have one shopping trip to an arcade near us. It's at Luton, an Arndale Centre, and we went there before we were married, and he seemed to love it. But I just say that that one day of the year, you come out with me and help me choose the presents that we want for the family. And the trouble is that whenever we go, we choose what we're having. I go to line up to pay, and when I look round, he's gone. He's disappeared, and I don't see him again for ages. So when we did this year just gone by, there I was in the queue, and blow me down if he didn't disappear again. And after 10 minutes, I rang him and I said, "Where are you?" And he said, "Do you remember when we used to come here when we were courting, and we noticed that lovely little jewellery shop on the corner outside?" I went, "Yeah, I do." And he said, "And do you remember that we saw in the window those lovely eternity rings that were all sparkling with diamonds? And you said you'd really like one of those one day." And bearing in mind that Christmas was coming up, I said, "Yeah." And then he said, "And do you remember that we decided that we really hadn't got the money at that point, but if in the future that we did have, that I'd like to buy one for you?" I went, "Yes." He said, "Well, I'm in the cafe next door having a bacon butty. I'm starving. What do you think?" Would you ever do that, Mark? Are you romantic?
Am I romantic? Yeah, Beloved says I'm romantic. We're not actually
really good.
Married, but I did get her a nice engagement ring. At least I hope she liked it. She still likes it, don't you?
An engagement ring.
Yeah.
Love.
I think I'm romantic. What would we say? Yeah, I am, I suppose, yes.
How long have you been together?
14 years.
Oh, well, that's lovely. And you're still romantic. I think you're onto a winner there.
We met actually, online.
Carry on.
We met online.
Did you?
Yes. And, I mean, well, as you know, I'm 64. She's 61. And I really didn't think I'd have a partner anymore, because I don't generally do the relationship thing very well. And I've never been with anyone for more than 3 years before. So we met quite by chance. And we were, at that point, we were living 135 miles apart. Oh. And because she had a real job, and I'm officially retired and have been retired for a while because of some health issues, it was me moving, not her moving.
Oh.
And so at first I commuted between them, but it's a long way. And I now live here, which is in Cumbria, South Cumbria. I'm from Merseyside, but we live in South Cumbria, in Barrow, near the lakes. And I guess we're happy enough. You know, we don't agree about much, but we're very different people. Very different people.
But, I think it's lovely when romance stays alive. Oh, what was she saying? What was your partner saying then?
She was sticking her thumb up towards me, and you didn't actually say anything, did you? No, she didn't say anything. She just stuck her thumb up.
Oh, well, that's good. One of the hats that I wear and have done for many years is that I'm a patron of Methodist Homes for the Aged. And I don't even remember, in Alverstoke, I think there used to be one of them. And they're all over the country, they're residential care homes. And one of our homes, on one particular day, two new residents arrived on the same day, virtually met on the doorstep. And it was a lovely little Irish lady called Mary and a sort of ex-military man called Joe. And I think because of all the confusion of that day, they made friends on the doorstep. And that was a friendship that saw them through for quite a while. And over the months that followed, romance blossomed. Mm-hmm. And eventually, Joe plucked up courage to ask Mary if she would marry him. And she said yes. She was ever so thrilled. And they spent the next couple of hours talking about all the wonderful plans they were going to have. And then it was only half an hour before tea time, so they decided to go back to their separate rooms and meet again for tea. And it was when Joe got back inside his own room, he thought, "Do you know, I know that I asked Mary to marry me, but did she actually say yes?" And he was so worried about it. In the end, he hurtled down the corridor and banged on her door. And when she opened it, he blurted all of this out. And she just laughed. And she said, "Oh, Joe, I'm so glad you've come, because I knew I said yes to someone, but I couldn't remember who." And that comes to us all, doesn't it? Memory problems. Yes. Well, I've been writing books for a long, long time, ever since I've been working on Songs of Praise. How old do you think Songs of Praise is, by the way?
1950s, did it start?
Not quite. It was 1961, which means it's 60 years old next year. 1961, so that's a very long time ago for a programme to have been on every Sunday. And I've been doing it for, I started in 1987, so 33 years. And I'm still on the team. I'm filming for them next week, but I realise now that I'm the diversity element. I'm the OAP that they have to have on, I think, really. But it's still very nice to be part of it. And it is a programme. Do either of you watch Songs of Praise?
Sometimes.
Ever? Have you done?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
We went to Cardiff Songs of Praise for the Millennium.
Oh, my goodness. I remember that. Yeah, wow.
We went from Bridge Mary Church, where I go. We had a whole coach load. It was wonderful.
Ah, oh, Cliff Richard.
Yeah. All the harps. Yes, that was lovely. Yeah.
It was quite something.
It was. That was really, we had a lovely time.
And Prince Charles and Prince Harry and Prince William came, didn't they, in the middle?
Yes, in the middle, yes.
It was quite difficult. It was Don McLean. Do you remember Don McLean was presenting it with me? And we did an hour that was just for the people in the stadium, and then an hour when we were live on television, and then an hour after that. It was quite a long event. And Prince Charles and the princes ended up arriving early in the hour when we weren't supposed to be on air. So you have no idea what was going on in my earpiece then. It was all very panicky, but we finished together. And there were 66,000 people at that event, which I remember being in the middle of the stadium and looking at, and I couldn't see individual faces. It looked like ants because people were so far away. And it was really nice to see the programme afterwards and see real people's faces and how much they were enjoying it.
Yes.
And that's the only one you've been to?
I went to the Big Sing at the Royal Albert Hall.
And when was that?
I can't remember, Pam.
A long time. Was I on it, or was it someone else?
2003.
Oh, right.
Where we've had lockdown, I've been sorting out books, and I found the programme. Yeah, 2003. Yeah. But you taped about three programmes in that at the Royal Hall. You did three in one night. So that was really...
That's right. You do Christmas, and you do one for September as well. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know that Songs of Praise is now no longer, after all these years, actually produced by the BBC. Oh. It's an independent company, which is like a facilities company with an outside broadcast unit in Wales and a production company in Manchester. And actually, they're not the best of friends, but they're making it work. And they've just got another 3-year contract. So it is good to know that Songs of Praise will remain because it's the only Christian programme on television at all at the moment. So
it's regular.
You don't know how long it will last, do you really? No. But I started writing because a publisher asked me about if I would write a book about behind the scenes on Songs of Praise. And I thought, you know, those stories that people share, which have been of such a pleasure down the years. Sorry, Mark, were you saying something? Did you want to say something?
Sorry,
did I interrupt you, Mark?
No, Beloved interrupted me from the side. I shall tell her to be quiet.
Oh, that's all right then. That's okay.
It's okay,
they wanted me to write a
Beloved
book
is working,
the scenes,
by the way.
And I made it, I decided to write it as a fictional book instead of a factual book because those very moving stories that that they share with me on Songs of Praise are not really mine to tell once years have gone by and you don't know what's happened to them. So I wrote a book called this one. It's... With Hearts and Hymns and Voices, which is about the making of a Songs of Praise program in a little Suffolk village for Palm Sunday. And after that, got sort of headhunted by a very big publishers to write an ordinary novel, a secular novel for mainstream reading, one a year. And, you know, I was thinking, what on earth shall I write about? And I thought, I'll write about what I know for the first one. And I started writing a book called The Trespassers. And it was about a vicar who got a little too close to one of the parishioners while he was helping her in her faith. And anyway, I had to deliver this in the March, and in the June, when it was coming out just before Christmas, the one of the mainstream newspapers, a Sunday newspaper, suddenly got a sniff that they thought that a Songs of Praise presenter was writing a book about a vicar having an affair, which wasn't it at all. And I suddenly picked up a Sunday newspaper that said God Slot Pam's Sex Book Shock, which was quite a shock to me too, really. And I rang my mum in Gosport, who was the only person in OAP herself who had actually read the manuscript at that point, and said, you'll never guess what, they're saying that I've written a steamy, sexy potboiler. And she said, oh, I must have missed that bit. What page was that on? So that was the start of writing, really, for me. But let's move on to this one, which is the one I'm supposed to be talking to you about, which is Arthur's Garden. And you'll see that at the front of it, there is a wooden plaque which says Arthur's Garden on it. I was asked by a publisher if I would write a book about gardens with lots of quotations and verse and bits and pieces in, and I thought that sounded a bit boring. And then I looked out of my own kitchen window, and there was that wooden plaque that says Arthur's Garden. And it came from my and Terry's great uncle Arthur, who was born in 1906 and died in 1986, that's 80 years later exactly, in the same house. That house was in Maidstone in Kent, and it was one of those typical terraced houses. I bet you've got a nan or a mum who had a house just like this. You may even have one yourself, because they're the best houses ever. A row of terraced houses where out the back everybody has a strip of garden. Do you know what I mean? When you stood in this particular house, you could look up the hill and see lots of gardens just the same, and down the hill as well. Except that Uncle Arthur's garden was always a picture. And he learnt his gardening skills from his dad, Tom, and his wife, Emily. They were born in 1890 something. And Tom had always loved taking care of his garden. And he instilled that love of gardening in it for his son, for Arthur. And Arthur, well, there were lots of sort of tips from the old days that Arthur learnt from his father. I mean, one of them was about if you want to know whether the garden, the ground is ripe for sowing seeds, then his old granddad would have said to him, take off your trousers and sit on the ground. You'll soon know if the soil's warm enough. And actually, that sounds like a bit of an old wives' tale, but apparently the very best of Queen Victoria's under gardeners could be found in early spring, squatting bare-bottomed in the palace kitchen garden, their faces in deep concentration, because their jobs relied on the harvest. And it was a well-known fact that if seeds were planted when the ground was still too cold, then the wet spring weather before the wet spring weather was over, then the ground might not have had a chance to warm up and the crops would fail. So that's the way to do it. And obviously that's the way to do it in your own gardens as well, if you need to know. Right, well then, actually, of course, Arthur was born in 1906, but by the time he was eight, the First World War broke out. Now, none of his family, there were 11 in that family, two babies actually died, one lived a day old, the very first one that was born to Emily, and one was a twin who was born stillborn, as happened in those days. But Arthur was number eight. And his eldest brother, Ernest, was only 16 when the war broke out. But in 1916, they brought in a military law which said that anyone over the age of 18 would have to go to war. And so he signed up literally 2 days after his 18th birthday, having just got engaged to his childhood sweetheart. And she embroidered for him, and you may have seen some of these, especially living in a military town. she embroidered a hanky with forget-me-nots on and a little poem that she put on which said, "These dear little blossoms of dainty blue say please take care as I'm thinking of you. Remember, I love you, I'm faithful and true from one who, though distant, will not forget you." And Arthur went down to the banks of the Medway and he picked himself a smooth stone, which he spent days buffing and just making as smooth and polished as he could. And he just wrote on it, he carved into it, "Come home." And he said to Ernest as he gave it to him, "I put all my prayers in this, you have got to come home." But what happened was that he remembered, of course, there was that moment when Ernest marched away up the road, at the path at the back of the garden, and they stood and watched and saw him for what turned out to be the last time, because 5 months later in Flanders, for the very first time, the British introduced tanks to the battlefield, and for 7 days at Fleur-Consulette on the Somme, the Allies fought for their lives against the Germans until finally, on the 22nd of September 1916, the British were declared victorious. Now, bearing in mind that Ernest had only gone about a month before, Ernest didn't know that. 24 hours earlier, in one of the final rallies of that battle, he had fallen in no man's land and he never came home again. Now, the effect that had on the family lasted for many generations, but the effect on the garden was one which also lasted for many generations, because what the family decided to do was to plant a small budded white rose on the back fence in memory of Arthur. And the blooms from that white rose formed a display at the funeral that they had for him, although they had no body. They had a funeral service for him, and the white roses were there, or they used white roses, and that was why they bought a white rose bush. And also, they were apparently in nearly every family wedding bouquet after that for many years to come. So that's a lovely story. Well, actually, in the garden as well, do you remember, I don't know if you remember, Terry, how that garden always had a tin bath in it? Because bath night was quite something, and you might remember this from your own lives. Well, Arthur had a very good friend, Wilf, who lived next door to him, a childhood friend, and Wilf said to him one night, "Is bath night still Friday at your house?" Because Arthur was out in the garden working and he had his head over the garden. Arthur said, "Well, that's right. As soon as we filled the tub, Dad's in first, then Dick and Harry if they're home, Ada's next, then me, and after Harry and Beau are ready for bed, if there's any hot water left, then Mum will go in. And does your mum still insist on lining you all up for a spoonful of castor sugar?" asked Will. Castor oil. Yes, you remember that. "Friday night every week," said Arthur. "She says it keeps us regular." So Wilf spluttered with laughter. No wonder there's always a long queue for the privy in your backyard then on Saturday mornings. And suddenly his expression turned to one of horror as he looked at what Arthur was doing. "What are you up to?" And he said, "Well, I'm just giving the cabbages a drink of beer." "But that's beer you're pouring on them. Why are you doing that?" "We said it's just the dregs from Dad's homemade brew. Cabbages love beer. It makes them grow." "I'm a growing trap," said Wilf. "Don't waste beer on cabbages. I'll have it." Well, Arthur grinned as he wiped his hands on his shoulders. "Well, I'm done here now. Do you want to walk up to the stable with me?" "Whatever for?" said Wilf. "I need some manure for the strawberries." Wilf's face puckered up with disgust. "Yuck, we'd rather put tinned cream on ours." Right, so Arthur married Daisy. They had two children, Alice and Tommy. There was another war, of course. Now, Arthur had a protected profession because he was a chippy in Chatham Dockyard. In fact, a lot of the men in those Medway towns, as would have been the case in Gosport and Portsmouth too, had a very important job to do during the war years. But two of his brothers marched off to war, and it looked as if not both of them were going to come back, because they had a letter to say that Beau, the youngest boy, was missing, presumed dead, because he'd been sent off to the Far East. And they actually got an envelope, which obviously meant that he was unlikely to come home. And then there was the day when Harry came home, and Emily heard his familiar whistle long before she saw him. Harry had always been the strongest of her boys, and yet the man who strode towards her now had a weariness etched into his face that had aged him far beyond his years. Seeing her at the gate, he broke into a run and scooped her up into his arms, holding his mum so tight she could hardly breathe. "Did you hear, Mum?" he exclaimed, stretching out his arms so he could see her properly. "Beau is alive. They got a message through to me at the barracks. The Japanese captured him in Singapore and he's been a prisoner of war ever since. But they're shipping him back now. He's coming home, Mum. We're all coming home." I guess that that was something that was familiar to many, many families over those war years. But of course, the life changed after that. And in Gosport, we see that more than ever, how it had to be rebuilt and how prefabs were built. Have we still got prefabs in Gosport? We certainly had them in Plymouth when we were there. But of course, they had bathrooms. And a lot of these old Victorian houses didn't have bathrooms. So they were very, very envious of that. But of course, in the garden, there were still the same old problems. And one of those problems were rabbits. Now, Arthur had a real problem because he couldn't get rid of them, whatever he tried. He tried every remedy he could think of. Like, they were supposed to turn their noses up at rhubarb and leeks. But they'd happily munch through the lot when he put them in between his beans, that of course they loved best of all. And he'd hung shiny cooking pots at the end of the rows until Daisy complained that she hadn't got enough cooking pots to actually cook a meal for the family. So would he stop doing that? He even borrowed a dog for a day or two, but that dog was so terrified of rabbits, he gave up on that. So the battle continued and the rabbits were winning paws down until the wonderful day when Wilf arrived at the door with a big green-eyed fur ball of a cat who apparently was a stray that had kept appearing at Handy Andy's, the do-it-yourself shop in Maidstone High Street, Pudding Lane, that he'd finally got himself a job in. He said he's a nice fellow and we've called him Sparky because the first time we saw him, he'd made himself at home in our electrical spares cupboard. And I wondered if your youngsters might like him. No, said Arthur. No, we could do without a cat, thank you. And Daisy's wife said, no, I don't think we need a cat. But then Alice, their daughter, said, well, his name is Sparky, like Sparky and the Magic Piano. He said, that's my favourite piece of music on Children's Hour with Uncle Mac on Saturday morning. So, yeah, we've got to keep him. And Arthur thought the whole thing was a terrible idea. But once Tommy had declared that Sparky was definitely going to sleep on his bed, well, he gave up trying to argue. And it wasn't until a few weeks later when he pulled back the bedroom curtains to see Sparky sitting firmly in the middle of the garden path with Wobbin, they always seem to have a Wobbin, not a Robin, a Wobbin, the kids couldn't say that, perched on the fence, looking on with interest, and not a rabbit in sight. They were obviously terrified of Sparky the cat, so after that he decided Sparky could have extra rations of meat from now on. 2 weeks later, Sparky gave birth to three kittens. He'd obviously met up with more than just electrical sockets in the electrical spare parts cupboard. So Daisy took her to the vets, found homes for the kittens, and Sparky was a much loved member of the family for many years to come. Right, well then, of course, all sorts of things were happening in the meantime. But in the garden, there were the newfangled gadgets that were coming along. Now, Tommy, Arthur's son in this time, had grown up enough to have a couple of children of his own, and he'd moved out of the old terrace house area of Mason, and he moved into the spanking new houses with big gardens that were a bit further away. Now, Tommy had never shown any interest in gardening at all until he had his own garden, and then he was actually asking his dad for a bit of advice. So there was a day when he said he'd got this new garden, they just moved in, and he said to Arthur, his dad said to him, do you want to borrow my lawnmower? And Tommy looks slightly awkward as he answers, well, that's a very kind thought, Dad, but I'm not sure your machine would be able to cope with all of this. And Arthur chuckled, do you mean it's as archaic as its owner? Of course not, spluttered Tommy. No, I just meant thank you, but no thanks. I understand. I completely understand. Well, in that case, said Tommy, his face lightening up like a child's at Christmas, come and see this. And he hurried over to the door that led to the garage to the back garden. And as his son disappeared inside, Arthur tried to identify the intriguing sounds that preceded Tommy's reappearance. Then he emerged, pushing a sparkling, olive-green, state-of-the-art modern lawnmower. My goodness, that's a beauty, breathed Arthur, bending down to study the machine with admiration. Have you tried it yet? It only arrived yesterday, so today's the day. It looks easy enough. Do you want to go? Arthur stepped back. He said, I wouldn't dream of robbing you of your maiden voyage. Your lawn awaits. I would just sit up at the kitchen there and have a cup of tea as I cheer you on. So it took a bit of huffing and puffing for Tom to get his technique just right. But 2 hours later, the lawn was immaculate with straight, smart lines right down to the fence at the back. Said Arthur approvingly. I might have to borrow that. But of course, being an old codger who could so easily chop my toes off with such a newfangled contraption, I'll have to ask you to bring it round once a week in the summer to mow my little patch of lawn for me. And that reminded me of something that Eric Morecambe said around the same time. You remember Morecambe and Wise? He said, my neighbour asked if he could borrow my lawnmower. And I told him, of course he could, as long as he didn't take it out of my garden. Which seems fair enough. Right, so we're coming to the end of our time with Arthur. Daisy died in 1984, and Arthur then 2 years later in 1986 had his 80th birthday, and at that birthday party his children presented him with the Arthur's Garden placard, which he was so thrilled with because of all the years of love and knowledge he put in after his father had done much the same. And that Christmas, because he was born in April, on Christmas Day, he had a lovely day with his family, a lovely, heartwarming day. And he came back to sit in the armchair that his mum used to sit in, which was looking out the little narrow window that looked out down the length of this tiny little garden that he'd loved so dearly. And he sat there and reminisced, and he fell asleep. And actually, he had a heart attack in that chair and died. So I just want to tell you the epilogue of what happened after, because of course houses had to be sold when there was no one left in the family that could take it on. And very reluctantly the family had to decide to sell the house on. And it was bought by a young couple with a small baby. And the husband was a DIY enthusiast who saw the house as a doer-upper. And within a year, every room had been gutted and redesigned. The attic turned into a study and the cellar became a playroom for their little boy. The coal depot that for so many years had stood across the back lane had gone. And the land had been redeveloped to become a new estate of starter homes. And the young couple were pleased because this would mean there may be playmates there for their little lad. And the surprisingly beautiful garden that they discovered at the back of the house when they first saw it had been an important factor in their decision to buy in the first place. But as the months passed, they realised that neither of them had the experience of gardening, and the back garden had become overgrown and uncared for. And eventually the new owners thought there was nothing for it but to concrete it over, building in a sandpit for their son, a rotary washing line for the wife, and a barbecue for sunny weekends. But before the house had been sold, Arthur's son, Tommy, had got to work with his secateurs and potting compost. He'd taken down the greenhouse pane by pane, reconstructing it in the back corner of his own garden. He dug out rooted clumps of plants and shrubs and roses, especially Ernest's white rose, which he carefully removed to his new home along the fence that his wife Belinda could see from her kitchen window. And in the flower bed, directly in front of their large patio doors, Tommy dug in the sign that read Arthur's Garden. And on the morning when the first frost breathed its silvery coating across the lawn, Tommy drew back the bedroom curtains to see a visitor in the garden. Sitting on the sign, his head cocked to look Tommy straight in the eye, sat their old friend, Wobbin, who had been a friend of the family for so long. They stared at each other like the old friends they were for just a moment before Wobbin threw back his head and chirruped to welcome the morning sun. So that's the end of Arthur's Garden and the end of our time together. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yes, very good. Very good.
Lovely. Well, it's so... True, say that again.
It's a true story that you're talking about, or everything happened.
Yes, it is. In fact, the story of Arthur's Garden is not completely factual, because obviously the publishers who asked me were after something which the garden was the star, and I had to just alter some of the details of the family just to make it be a typical family, as no family is really typical, is it? So, but basically it is the story of our family and probably of yours and many other people's, I think.
Very nice. Yes, lovely.
Did it bring back memories for you?
Yes, my granddad always had an allotment, and I was allowed to go with him. I can remember that. And he used to put me in the wheelbarrow, but he used to say, if you come, you can't come home in the wheelbarrow because I'll have all the things in there. You've got to walk.
Wow.
I always remember that. But it was always lemonade and biscuits when we went down the allotment. So it was quite enjoyable.
Oh, it was worth the trip, even if you did have to walk back then. And are you a gardener?
No, I live in a flat now, so I haven't got a garden.
Well, that's probably quite good, I would have thought. Let someone else do the work.
Yes.
And what about you, Mark? Are you a gardener?
Well, there's no real room for a garden where we live. We live in a terrace in But my grandfather, my mother's father, had an allotment.
Did he?
We occasionally went there. But my father was a nurseryman, self-employed nurseryman. And he grew bedding plants and wallflowers and chrysanthemums twice a year. And he did wreaths and crosses for the church, and he supplied into floral shops, and he did a little local retail. But in the end, it was forced out of business by the big concerns with many employees and many acres. And then there was a freak storm in 1983, which more or less destroyed it. And he had to wind up then. But I grew up surrounded by plants and by tanks of water with mosquitoes breeding in them. And I remember listening to the song, An English Country Garden.
Yes.
When it was in the charts. And also Rolf Harris's parody of it.
Yes.
About wet underfoot and the leaves are thick with soot and so forth. But so although I've never been a gardener, my brother's wife is a keen gardener, but again, they only have a very small garden. My mother used to like to garden. We had quite a big garden at the back of the house. And I remember 12 years ago now, it was very funny. It was the day they started the cyclotron in Switzerland. And it was predicted that there would be a little black hole and the world would end. And my brother came home at lunchtime and said to my mum, I see the world didn't end today. And mum said, oh, how would I know? I was in the garden. So you imagine.
And life goes on in the garden.
The whole planet's gone except for mum and the garden. Everything else is gone, you know.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, we enjoyed that. The trouble with being a nurseryman, a self-employed nurseryman, is that it's not a pastime. It's your life. And once his father got too old and too badly sighted to do much, it was dawn till dusk, 7 days a week, and there was no rest from it, and we could barely go away for a few days each year.
Yes.
And in the end, it wore him out, and for the last 50 years of it, oh no, not 50 years, how long? For the last 50 years of his life, he was also a type 1 diabetic, which didn't help. So I think he was glad when he finally was able to pack it in.
Yes.
But it was nice growing up with all the flowers and helping him in the vacations and things like that. So that's the nearest I've come to that.
All right. Well, it's nice to remember how gardens used to be and how families used to be, really. And it's lovely to have met you two. So thank you ever so much. We've been little but lovely, haven't we?
Can I
thanks
ask
to you, Terry, for organising it all.
No problem. It's been, you know, it's my family as well.
Yeah.
Interesting to hear.
Can I ask you, Pam, how many books have you written?
27. Well, I'm on number 27. Yes.
Very amazing.
I know. And at the moment, I'm recording 8 radio programs a week, plus an online television magazine program every week. So I am just literally working from morning to night, really. I don't know what day it is. What day is it? But yeah, I am really busy still. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I've written 7 books, but that's nothing like yours.
No.
And like, they're not like your books, I can tell you. And also I did once have my own radio show, but
good.
No, it's all but the stuff I write is fairly seriously academic for the most part. So
for the what?
Mostly it's pretty seriously academic, my writing.
Oh, right. What about?
Linguistics mainly.
Linguistics.
Linguistics, yes. I've been an academic. I've been a professional academic linguist. And,
How fascinating.
It's not many people read these books.
Let's see what theme Terry has for Hods next year, because if it's anything to do with language, she'll be right back to get in touch with you.
Be in contact with you, Mark.
please
thank
do us
you,
like
everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam.
Lovely to see you all.
Thank you, everyone. Bye. Lovely to meet you all.
Bye.
Bye.
Terry.